Our featured BBB Wise Giving Alliance accredited charity seal holders for this episode are PKD Foundation, Remote Area Medical, Sarcoma Foundation of America. To find out more about these and other BBB Wise Giving Alliance accredited charities, go to give.org.
You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
This is the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator, and it's your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor. Rita L. Saronin is the president and CEO of the Dave Thomas Foundation. And for more than 30 years, Rita has worked on behalf of abused, neglected, and vulnerable children, providing leadership for local, state, and national efforts, working to improve the juvenile justice and child welfare systems while striving to assure safe and permanent homes for North American children, and now leading the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption, a national nonprofit public entity since 2001, and the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption in Canada since 2003. She works to find permanent homes for more than 140,000 waiting children in North America's foster care systems. We're going to talk with her about this amazing work and also begin to understand her passion for this particular way of giving back. Rita, welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast.
Oh, thank you, Art, for having me. I'm so flattered that you asked.
Rita, let's get started with your background. You've been doing this work on behalf of children now for probably more years than you want to admit. But what is it that has kept you in this space? And what is it that has gotten you in it in the first place?
I think, Art, you know, I've thought about that a lot because I'm not an attorney. I'm not a social worker. I'm not one of the folks that we work with all the time. But I think I was born a child advocate. I was one of those kids that came out kicking and screaming, "It's not fair," when it had to do with what I perceived even as a child about injustice for children. And I was on an entirely different career path. But when my oldest daughter was born quite a few years ago, there was the death of an infant, and she was about 9 months old at the time. And there was a death of an infant in our community that passed away as a result of abuse. And I was primed at that point to try and understand how it is, as I was cradling my child, someone could harm a baby in that way. And so I quickly dropped what I was doing and started volunteering with what was then this was in Columbus, Ohio, the Ohio chapter of the Committee to Prevent Child Abuse, because I thought there's got to be something that I can do. This spoke to me finally about what my internal drive was, but I hadn't figured that out professionally yet. And started out as a volunteer there, created some programs that worked with parents and their children, learned as much as I could about the dynamics of abuse and neglect. Why do parents move to this stage? What is it that's underneath all of that? Because most parents don't intend to harm their children. And that turned into a staff position, and I was there for a number of years, and then had the opportunity to move and become the executive director of the court-appointed special advocate program, which provides trained community volunteers to act as volunteer guardians ad litem for children who have been abused or neglected, and now they're involved in court proceedings, and they provide independent best interest voices for a judge to consider among all of the things that come on the judge's bench. And so I learned from that what happens when our prevention efforts fail, that a child's then involved in the court system, and how do we make sure that their lives move forward in the way that they deserve so that they can become thriving young people and adults. And learned everything then about the juvenile justice system and the social welfare system and the intersection of education and healthcare and juvenile justice and all of those complex systems that surround children and families, and tried to always take it down to one child, one case at a time, but learned as much as I could. And was there nearly a decade, and then had the opportunity and applied for the position here at the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption, which when I was able to move in this position, sort of felt like full circle to me. I'm never sure quite where that full circle ends, but from prevention to intervention, then what happens when our best efforts, hopefully our best efforts, have failed on behalf of a child, and now they're a legal orphan in this country. And so it felt like the best next step for me, and I can move from a local statewide scale to a national scale to do this work. So it was both that combination art of finally discovering what I think it is I was meant to do, or what the plan was all along and I just didn't realize it, and then taking that leap that of faith that I could do this, even though I wasn't, for example, trained as an attorney and working in the child welfare system, or trained as a social worker and working in this complex system of child welfare.
Well, obviously you have a passion for it because you wouldn't have stayed that long. But I also wonder, given what you obviously have seen, some of the real tragedies that exist within child welfare and foster homes and the method in which, ways in which some children unfortunately are abused. I wonder if why you haven't burned out from this. I mean, it certainly wouldn't be unreasonable for someone to work in this space for a while and just say, you know, I can't take this anymore. But yet you've persevered. What is you think that has been able to keep you in it for so long?
I think part of it is my sense of responsibility that there have to be adults advocating for children. There have to be adults. Even when it's at its most difficult, a child can't do that. And so someone needs to step forward. Not to say that I'm the one that makes the difference, but I needed to be part of that cone of responsibility on behalf of children. And I've had the unique opportunity throughout my career to have amazing mentors, amazing partners, amazing collaborators who also energize and feel a passion for this work. And so you pick and choose, right? When you're feeling like, I couldn't possibly do this another day, that's when you reach out to one of those folks and say, help me figure this out. Help me make sure that I'm on the right path. And help me make sure that I'm not so burned out that I'm not going to be effective at this job anymore. So I think it's both that sense of personal responsibility, caring as much as I do about children, looking at my own children and having them look to me to say, you know, I can think of one time I was a single parent at the time. It was a snow day. My kids were going to be home from school. They were old enough to be on their own, but I was feeling a little bit guilty. And I said, you know, I'm feeling so bad that I have to leave you and get to work. And my youngest daughter looked up at me and said, you get to work. You have to take care of those children. So, you know, it's even my own children saying, nope, keep up, keep doing the work.
Well, you talked about just how complex the systems are that have our kids to some extent within them, whether that be child welfare, the systems we have around juvenile justice, the system we have for fostering and adopting children, schools even. There are lots of systems that healthcare that have to be connected up for us to really address some of the real challenges that young people have. How have you been able to navigate those systems to really identify the core places where you can make a difference?
It's a great question, and it's about digging in and understanding a couple of things. Who are the decision makers? What are the dynamics behind this? Is it legislative? Is it policy? Is it practice? And finding out where those points of interaction are, where if there needs to be change, is this where change can be made? And frequently I've found in these complex systems, it's not so much the structure themselves, it's how it's generated into practice, and sometimes ineffective practice. And so how do you work with folks to say, help me understand where the evidence is that's driving this practice. If there isn't evidence, let's find some. If it's practice that can be changed and it just needs funding or it needs a legislative bent to it, then let's test and make sure the practice works. And then let's find the other tools that keep it in place. So it's embedded as this is business as usual rather than, well, we do it this way because we've always done it this way. I think that's been most effective, particularly in the child welfare system. And look, yes, I deal with those intersections of systems. I'm not an expert in the education system. I would hope that it might work the same way, but I'm not certain. And then it's energizing and finding an alliance, a collaborative group. Again, typically those people that have a voice in the system, and frequently it's a lived experience voice, and getting their input, that's particularly helpful in the child welfare system of young people that have aged out of the child welfare system, for example, without a family, or folks who were in the system and went back home, but they've got that deep experience that I was never in the system, I'll never understand, but you can help me understand what was effective for you, what wasn't effective for you, and where can we all work together to step in and make it better. So I think it's really deeply taking apart what might seem impenetrable from the outside. It's much too complex. It's riddled with rules, regulations, policies, practices, and procedures. And then digging in and finding out it's just a human-centered effort. As humans, we can get back in and figure this out.
Well, you work now, and you've been working for some time with the Dave Thomas Foundation. And I'm sure all of our listeners have heard of Dave Thomas because of Wendy's, and many of us have enjoyed the food that Wendy's produces. But apparently Dave decided that he wanted to do something with his wealth and obviously had a great affinity for children. But tell us about Dave Thomas's story that led him to start a foundation that leads to the kind of work that you're doing.
It's a wonderful story. And one would think that a food organization like Wendy's, if they're going to align with a cause, they would align with something like perhaps food insecurity, right? There's a natural link there. How did it happen with adoption? Dave Thomas was adopted, and he was adopted as an infant, but he is not unlike the children we deal with in the foster care system because he went through a lot in his young life. His adoptive mother passed away when he was 5. His father was very much an itinerant worker, moving from place to place, so he was constantly moving. And in fact, he was raised for much of his life by his grandmother, Minnie. That sounds exactly like so many of our kids in foster care. And in fact, when he was 15, his father decided to move somewhere else to a new job, and Dave said, I'm not moving, I'm going to stay here, and he dropped out of school, and that was in Fort Wayne, Indiana at the time. And his job then, he worked at what was a hobby house restaurant. And that's where he discovered his passion for food service. And he said at that time, someday I'm going to develop the best hamburger. I mean, at that young age, he already had a clear path of what he was going to do professionally. Learned a lot. He, you know, grew up and became this international icon in the 90s when he was appearing in commercials on behalf of the Wendy's company. I mean, he started this business in 1969. With one restaurant in Columbus, Ohio, and grew it into an international business. But as he was nearing the end of his role as CEO of the company, he wanted to make public and do something more for what was already in the Wendy's company DNA, which was giving back to the communities in which they were making doing good business and making money. And so that's when he decided that it would be time to maybe think about a foundation. But not a corporate foundation, not a family foundation, but a national nonprofit public charity. And he zeroed in on foster care adoption because at that time in 1992, when he started this, there wasn't a robust conversation about children in foster care and children waiting to be adopted in foster care then. And it hasn't changed a lot, but then if people were thinking about adopting, their first thought was infant adoption. And that could either be domestic infant or international infant, but they weren't thinking about children right here who were waiting to be adopted. And so he created the foundation to do two things, to raise awareness about the foster care system, about children in foster care, and then also made us a grant-making organization so that as we were out raising funds for the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption, awareness wasn't enough. We needed to be able to create partnerships and share those funds with others that were doing good work on behalf of children waiting in foster care to be adopted. And he created us with a very simple mission. We're a one-trick pony to dramatically increase the adoptions of North America's foster care children who are waiting to be adopted. And so we have to know and understand and work with all facets of the system that we've already talked about. But really, our main mission is to get these children who are in foster care, who've been freed for adoption, to get them into permanency and get them into families.
And now it's time for our giving tips segment with Bennett Weiner, one of the world's most renowned experts on charity accountability and the COO of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance.
During the spring and summer, a number of people think of volunteering, but I'd like to talk today about a special type of volunteering called volunteering vacations. There are opportunities such as volunteering for charities in terms of teaching English to children, assembling storage sheds, building ramps for disabled people, or working in an orphanage. There are all types of things that are available out there in terms of activities you can do for charities while you're perhaps visiting an area that you want to go to. But before you pack your bags, a few tips that you should consider. First of all, check out the organization. Is it one that you want to support? Does it meet our BBB charity standards? That should be a first step. Also, make sure you know who pays for the transportation and housing there. I mean, don't assume that the organization is going to take care of it. It may be on your tab. And you also need to make sure if medical insurance that you have covers costs incurred abroad, so that if you need medical help, you'll be able to get it. And of course, if you're going to another nation, you may need, in some cases, to have certain immunizations in place as needed. And finally, learn about the living conditions and physical requirements in whatever area you're going to. Just because you're volunteering doesn't mean it's going to be a dangerous area. It could be a very safe area where the charity is active in. So learn about that before you go. But it is an opportunity to use whatever specialized skills that you may have to help charity, and it's a way of helping organizations without cashing a check, but by doing things that you can to assist them in carrying out their work.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about the extent of the challenge. I think the number you mentioned was 140,000. Is that what we're talking about as the universe, or is there some broader number that we're also aiming for here?
So we have two foundations, as you mentioned early on, the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption U.S. and the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption Canada. And that responds to our mission of being North American. We're tiptoeing into Mexico right now, but we have not focused in Mexico. And so that number represents the United States and Canada of children waiting to be adopted. Those numbers just came down a little bit in the U.S. It's about 110,000 children in the United States and about 30,000 children in Canada who are waiting to be adopted. The systems are similar. There's enough nuance of difference that they're entirely different systems, but the systems are very similar.
So what are some of the economic challenges associated with having children, for instance, in foster care, as opposed to with a loving family?
Well, there are absolutely, you know, at the federal, state, and county levels, there are costs simply to provide children a home in foster care, recruiting and training foster care parents, managing children in that system. So there are social workers, there are processes and procedures. You know, there's a lot of money spent on the child welfare system from the federal and state levels. And more importantly, perhaps, the idea of getting a child to permanency. Here in this country, about 20,000 of those children who have been freed for adoption, who under our moral obligation to find them permanency, we create a lot of failures because for about 20,000 children every year, year over year over year, last year it was about 18,000 children, those children turn 18 and leave foster care without a family. And so there's an additional cost there when you think about the cost to society. The likelihood of good outcomes for those children who age out of care sometimes are reduced, and not because they're bad kids, but because they don't have that safety net of family. They don't have the benefit of a mentoring relationship of a parent. They can't make a mistake. They're 18 and they've got a job and a car breaks down and they can't get to work and they're fired. They can't go home and say, I need some help for a few weeks while I get myself back up on my feet. So they're at a much higher risk of being homeless, of being undereducated, of being underemployed or unemployed, of becoming early parents, of moving into not positive behaviors, substance abuse, of falling back into the criminal justice system, perhaps. Again, all of those costs, those after costs of not having provided appropriate permanency, of not dealing well with children in foster care when we should have, of really looking at where are the resources being spent, create billions of dollars of additional burden on communities rather than, first of all, let's keep kids from coming into care. How do we make sure that families have all of the resources and supports that they need so that they don't move into a system like the foster care system? The majority of children who come into foster care come in because of neglect, and much of that is associated with poverty, not because someone has intentionally harmed a child through physical or sexual abuse. Well, if we said, wait a minute, what supports can we provide to families and help them with housing, help them with food, help them with job security, then we diminish significantly the number of children who move into the foster care system. So there's that complex weaving of both what do we feel about families. You know, we still apply judgment to families that, oh, for some reason it's a negative judgment if they need a hand, if they need a lift, if they need some assistance, rather than that's, of course, that's what we do. Because when families thrive, communities thrive. So we've got to get over a lot of our individual and, frankly, system beliefs about what families look like, about how they can and should thrive, and about what we need to do to keep them on the right path toward thriving in the community.
Now, you and I were together this week at an event that your foundation was generous enough to host and to sponsor with the group called Trauma Free World. And this organization is trying to stand up the idea that every caregiver should have the resources they need to provide the right kind of support for children. And I would say that it was quite a remarkable event, but we also got to talk a bit about some of the challenges that young people face in their circumstances. And what are some of the more prevailing traumas that young people have to work through as they become adults? What have you observed?
Absolutely. And I think if folks think for just a moment, think about yourself as, let's say, a 10-year-old, and you're already in a difficult situation at home. You've been either physically abused or it's a family that's on the edge of homelessness. So you've already experienced some level of trauma, or there's domestic violence in the home, or there's the death of a parent in the home. Those layers of trauma have already been placed on that child. But now imagine at some point a police officer comes to your home and says, we need to take you out of this home and we're going to put you in a strange home. No matter what your circumstances are, you identify with that home. And so you're going to feel another layer of trauma, of loss, of grief. And depending on how long you stay in that alternate home, or if you never go home, or if you go back and forth a number of times, or if you move multiple times, which happens to too many of our children in the foster care system before they go home, each one of those moves, each one of those transitions adds another layer of trauma. But so these profound, I think, interweaving of loss, of grief, and of trauma suddenly are heaped on the shoulders of our children. And if we don't recognize that it's there, both as caregivers, as educators, as system players, the judge at the bench that's making decisions based on perhaps a behavior that then shows itself in this child as a result of the trauma, and we don't understand where that's coming from, and so we think, well, they're just a bad kid, as opposed to this is a child that has experienced the kind of trauma no child should experience. that's the kind of the work that we're doing with the Alliance and Trauma Free World is so important, that we give tools to anyone that surrounds these children, whether you're a foster parent or an adoptive parent or someone else that surrounds these children. You have to know and understand what resources are to help you help this child understand where these behaviors are coming from and how you can react appropriately and get the right kinds of services in place so that we can minimize the lifelong impact that trauma has on adults. And it does, make no mistake, no matter what trauma has been experienced, it becomes internalized. It becomes part of the biology of humans and has negative impacts on health issues potentially later on in life as well.
Well, you know, Rita, I just think that we have so many organizations that are out here trying to do something to support this. How do we begin to work together on these enormous challenge that we have here?
It's really one of the North Stars of the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption is we never intended to do this alone. This is always in collaboration. It's always understanding where do these children live and how do we work better with the systems that surround them. So, for example, we have an evidence-based signature program that we put in place nearly 20 years ago that addresses this population of children that are most at risk of aging out of foster care, teenagers, children in sibling groups, children with special needs, children that have been in care for so long that they resist efforts at permanency and say, just let me age out, I'll be fine. And unfortunately, the system tends to listen to them at that point. And so this program that we created works only in collaboration. It has created public-private partnerships so that we work with governments. It's created agency partnerships with the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption. It's a grant-funded program, but in that funding is a partnership that says, let's work together, and together we will figure a way to get these children to permanency so that they can thrive best. So we do that through signature programs, but we do it through all of our other efforts, our advocacy efforts, our communication efforts. It's all about how do we come together? How do we most effectively serve these children? And no one can do this alone. And our job is to figure out a way to do a community, whether it's a community of funders, a community of agencies, a community of child welfare commissioners, a community of governors, whomever touches these children, we have to do it in community.
Well, I know you have a tough job to do to help these young people, but there's moments of joy, too, that I'm sure you experience. I would love to hear either a story or an experience that left you feeling really full of joy and excitement because what you were able to achieve.
There are so many stories. In fact, we've created a storytelling bank, essentially, of videos of dozens and dozens of the families that have come together through the work of the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption. But I can think of maybe two that in particular that really said, yeah, we're on the right path. One was this one young man. He was maybe 8 or 9 years old, and the foundation through this program that we created was working with this young man. He was very shy. He had been in care most of his life at that stage. And it took a while for the staff that were working with him to get him to trust them, understandably, and to even talk to them. But when they finally did and developed this relationship, he began to talk about all of the important people in his life. But what the person that came to the top of that list was his best friend and his best friend's family. And he had been going back and forth, interacting with that family for a couple of years. The family wasn't keenly aware of his circumstance. They knew that he was in foster care, but they didn't know he was waiting to be adopted. And so as the staff person was talking to him and said, you know, if you had your ideal world, where would your ideal world be? Where would you live? Where would you go? Who would you be when you grow up? And he said, I would live with my best friend's family. They'd be my family. And so the staff person went to that family immediately and said, here's the circumstance. What do you think? They said, oh my gosh, we didn't even know he was available for adoption. No one reached out to us. We absolutely would love to have him join our family. So fast forward to the court hearing. Everything moved forward. And the judge at the desk is talking to everyone, making sure that this adoption can go forward, not only legally, but is this what's best for this child? And good judges will ask the children themselves if they're old enough to be part of the communication. And he asked this young man, "So what do you think? Is this what's right for you? Is this what we should I say yes to this adoption?" And again, this little guy was just so shy. It took the judge a couple of proddings, and he finally said, "Look, we're not going to continue until I hear from you, because you're the most important voice in this courtroom." So he lifted his head and he looked the judge square in his eyes, and he said, "Yes, because now my best friend is going to be my brother." And so that adoption was finalized. There's another story of a young woman who had been in foster care, again, most of her life. We didn't get her on our caseload until she was 16. She had essentially been re-abused in foster care in terms of medical neglect. She had a series of ear infections that were never taken care of. And so she was deaf in one ear and partially deaf in another ear. Once the staff person on this case came to her, and at 16, she assumed she was going to age out. And that's what she kept telling the worker. You know what? Just let me get out of here. Let me get out of this system. I will be fine. And the worker said, "Nope, we're going to find you a family." And she was Hispanic. She found a family that fit her culture. And this young lady was adopted at age 17 when everyone else has given up on these kids. She became a thriving artist. She makes beautiful art and, in fact, was on the road, I think a couple of years ago, was accepted at the college of her choice and was moving on to college. And so I guarantee that this young woman would have aged out of foster care and would have had to have found her way on her own. And she probably would have done that. But it's that we put that on their shoulders to make them do that, rather than saying, "Here's a family. You can work with them. You can live with them. You can love with them. And you don't have to do this alone." So we have story after story after story like that, where the most perhaps forgotten children, we see you and we have not forgotten them.
How wonderful. Well, you know, one of the other things I know you value is your accreditation with the BBB Wise Giving Alliance. And I wanted to just hear you talk about why that's so important to the Dave Thomas Foundation and to you.
It's critically important. And it was my honor to be able to introduce you the night that we were together and to meet you face to face, because this is an organization that we have respected for so many years, that there are actually people behind that organization and those forms we fill out was wonderful. But it's what I go back to. We talked early on that we're a fundraising organization. We're a foundation, but we're a fundraising foundation. And in order to do this work at the level that we need to do it, we have a footprint in all 50 states. In order to do this work, we have to have dollars coming in the door. And we've got a great partnership with our Wendy's partners, and they do an incredible amount of fundraising for us through their customers. But we also have deep and robust fundraising strategies. And whether we ask for a dollar or $1 million from an individual or from a corporation or from another foundation or from a company, I want them to know that every one of those dollars that they give us is stewarded in a way that they can trust giving a donation to us. And so making sure that we meet each and every standard that the BBB Wise Giving Alliance puts in place and making sure that we do it at the highest level is our responsibility, and that we can get that green check on our website, that we can say we are a trusted organization of the Better Business Bureau Wise Giving Alliance, I think gives credibility and engenders trust for our donors. We want to make sure that we're the kind of organization that someone wants to invest in. And sometimes the only way they can really believe us is through a third-party source. And that's what you all become to us.
Well, wow. Thank you for that. You truly understand the importance of what we do and why we do it. Well, I have one final question for you. And it is this. Futurist in me always wants to know, where are we headed? Do we have opportunities to really see change over the next decade? Are we going to pretty much be where we are, or are we going to fall backwards? There's a lot of shifts going on in our society right now. Things are changing faster than we can even comprehend. Is that going to really consume our kids, or is it going to help them thrive and become parts of loving families. What's your thoughts about that?
I think we have always have great opportunity for hope for children, and particularly now. It may not seem like it. Look, I think the divisiveness that this country has experienced the past few years, in a way, has always been there, but it's been elevated, it's been highlighted for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is the racial inequity conversations that permeate child welfare as well. It's become a reckoning point for us in the child welfare system. How do we address the overrepresentation of Black children in the child welfare system and the growing overrepresentation of Hispanic children in the child welfare system? How do we diminish this issue of poverty that intersects with the child welfare system? How do we prevent children and families from even becoming involved in the child welfare system? And all of that, there has been some incredible policy lately and practice from the feds on down that has put an emphasis on prevention, that has put an emphasis on committing dollars to not only prevention, but to post-adoption services, to dealing with things like trauma in children. And so I think everybody's rethinking this system in a way. There are extremes, of course, on both sides of completely eliminate the child welfare system to no, do more separation of children from families. We've pulled together, along with a number of funders, a group through the Bipartisan Policy Center that's looking at all of these issues that are very divided relative to the child welfare system and bringing everyone to the table to say, where do we find common ground? Where can we do what's best for children? All of those things are giving me hope, Art, in a way that I didn't necessarily have during the pandemic when things were looking very bleak, and particularly for children in the child welfare system. So I have great hope. It will outlive me. It will outlive my job here in seeing that come to fruition in the best possible way. But I believe it will happen.
Well, amen to that. Well, you've been listening to Rita Saarinen, who is the president and CEO of the Dave Thomas Foundation and a lifelong or career-long advocate, I should say, for young people, particularly those who are in the juvenile justice and the foster care systems, trying to get them adopted. And it's been just wonderful to have you visit with us on the Heart of Giving podcast, Rita. So we are really thankful. And let me just say to all of our listeners, especially ones listening for the first time, this is a weekly show. And you can find us on all major podcast platforms. So I hope you'll subscribe and become a regular listener. The stories like Rita's and others who are doing great work in our society need to be told and upheld. We do that here. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by sending a gift to give.org. That's give.org. And I can assure you that we would put that money to great use. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you back here next week.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's Terms of Service.